That's not you, Tom Gimble. You can't win.
You knew where I was going, John. Right off the bat, I was saying, gosh, why didn't I get the call in instead of being called today?
And, you know, I'm counting the calls. You're on line six, so technically you would have been a winner, Tom.
Oh, goodness gracious. Maybe next week.
Missed it by that much. Americans are suddenly finding it harder to land a job and keep it. What's going on here?
Well, I think what we're seeing is fear becoming a reality. And I think that we've been talking about the economy. We've been talking about, is it good for Main Street versus Wall Street? And we saw that the new jobs dipped a little bit last week for the June report. We saw that unemployment ticked up a little bit to 4%. And we're in this situation that companies are preparing for the unknown, really. Is it Biden? Is it Trump not getting into politics? Because which way are things going to go? And what that means globally, right? England's got a new prime minister. France is having political problems. There's always issues in China. So globally and domestically, we don't know where things are going to be. More regulation, less regulation, lower interest rates, staying flat. And companies aren't going to jump out there and do mass hiring. And for the past, really, the majority of the past 24 years, sans a couple blips, it's been mass hiring nonstop for 2.5 decades, and it really is a slowdown right now.
A slowdown. Unemployment is 4.1%, still below the average unemployment rate in America. Is 4% a problem for you, do you think?
4% isn't a problem to me, and I think anybody over the age of 35 years old, maybe 40, it's not a problem. But our reality is only comparable to what we know. And for people that are under the age of 28, 30 years old, they don't know high unemployment. They don't know 6.5% unemployment. Heck, they don't know 6% interest rates on a mortgage. And that's what you and I had, right?
When
we started.
So lucky.
I think that, so it's all, you know, people want to say this isn't bad, but if you don't know it, you don't know it. And that's what we've got now is a generation that's afraid. And again, I know we harp on some of the same topics, but you've got coming out of COVID, you've got working hybrid and remote, and then you've got this unemployment that you've never heard of before. And so when you have those three things, you've got social anxiety and a lack of know-how of how to go out and get something, meaning a job. And if they're not easy to get, and you have social anxiety, and you don't go into the office, and you don't do in-person interviewing, you put that together in a Venn diagram, and that center box becomes real small.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Tom. I also wanted to bring this up. We talked the other day about 60% of business leaders anticipate layoffs in the second half of this year, which is where we are now. And one of the things that they said is going to lead to these layoffs is AI taking over the workload of some human beings. Are you seeing that? What's your comment on that?
Yeah, I think we're a little bit away from AI taking over the workload. I think what it's doing is it's going to create efficiencies, and no different than online advertising took away from copywriters and different things. You know, we always use the horse and buggy to the car and the blacksmith becoming the mechanic and all those analogies because they're accurate. And so AI is going to make people's jobs a little easier, but are we going to see this mass reduction that 30% of the workforce is gone and it's all being done by computers? No, we're many years away from that, John.
Here's a headline from the BBC. Would having an AI boss be better than your current human one? Where do you think we are on that?
I think it's the same way we'd say is having an AI spouse better than having a girl.
Well, and
some
answer to that, Tom?
Some days you'd say yes, and some days you'd say no. And I think that's, I think, listen, we to report to a computer that's going to do that, that they're also going to monitor your work by the minute, by the second, right?
Yep.
You might not have somebody who's on you every day, but they're going to know exactly what you're doing, all the time, and they're not going to care about your dog, your grandma, your mom, your brother, your sister, your wife, your husband. So, no, I think we are definitely not better off with an AI box.
Well, we'll wrap it up here. The report from the BBC says that while the AI manager in motivating employees and getting them to do tasks in monitoring assignments, the sort of thing that a computer could do that you're talking about, has about a 44%, 42%, 45% success rate. When it is done in conjunction with a human manager, those efficiencies almost double, up to 75%. And maybe that's
exactly
the best use of it as a tool. And with that, we're out of time. Tom Gimbel, the job expert and founder of the LaSalle Network. Thank you, Tom.
Stay dry, stay safe, and stay cool, John.
Sarah Foster is an economy reporter at Bankrate.com. We talked about this story the other day. The average American feels they need to earn over $186,000 a year just to live comfortably. What are we to make of that, Sarah? Where does that number even come from?
It's a high number. It seems a little unrealistic, maybe, but I think a lot of it does come from where Americans feel like inflation is right now. Of course, prices are slowing. They're not rising as quickly as they once were, but they're not anywhere cheaper than they used to be either. I think it was really eye-opening when I plugged those numbers into the Bureau of Labor Statistics CPI calculator that $186,000 today has the same buying power as $44,000 back in the 1980s.
Wow. Do that again.
It's shocking, too. $186,000 in today's dollars has the equivalent buying power as about $44,000 in 1980.
Which, if nothing else, is a reminder that your million-dollar nest egg is not going to have the purchasing power in 20, 30, 40 years that it feels like it would have now. I mean, that's a study in inflation there, isn't it?
I think that's absolutely right. I kind of remember, I mean, I think about this survey that we did a lot. It's different than this one, but we asked Americans what they would have to achieve in their life to consider themselves successful. Very few people said being a millionaire. I thought maybe it was just because Americans are aspiring to live comfortably. I mean, who wants to shoot for the stars when you're barely kind of making it as it is? But maybe a lot of it also goes back to the fact that $1 million just really isn't what it used to be. It's not really, maybe it's not even a sign of success.
Were there any demographic breakdowns of note in this survey?
In this survey, what is most interesting to me is perhaps when you start looking at income levels. So we saw that Americans who are at kind of the lowest income spectrum, you know, they're making under $50,000, they say that their magic salary number would be $157,000 a year on average. And that compares with Americans on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. So those higher income earners, they say that they would, on average, have to earn about $100,000 more than those low-income earners.
Mm-hmm.
So something about it kind of brings up lifestyle inflation. I mean, living comfortably probably looks a lot differently when you're used to living with a lot more in general.
If you did, though, try and define what living comfortably would mean for the average American family, so let's put two adults and two children in a house, that they've paid a mortgage on and have annual expenses on, and let's let them go on a vacation once a year for a week or 10 days somewhere, and let's save for the kids' college, and let's pay medical deductibles, and let's have good dental. I mean, none of those are extravagant expectations, is what we want everybody to try and achieve. You're north of $100,000 there, aren't you?
Yeah, and you're definitely right there. I think living comfortably is a very subjective term, but what really became clear to me in this research and talking with Americans who feel this way themselves is that it really is overwhelmingly a story of not worrying about money and knowing that anything you need, you can afford without fearing that you'll have to skip a car payment, maybe even fall behind on your mortgage.
Yeah.
And all of those wealth building opportunities are so much more pricey than they used to be. That's actually especially where we've seen the biggest burst in the cost of living.
Well, and think about that. And in this scenario that we would use to define living comfortably, you don't have $5,000 on a credit card that's charging you 29 or 32%, and you have enough money in the bank to pay for a new washer and dryer if it suddenly breaks down. So you need thousands of dollars in savings, you know, that you can easily access. The average American, I think in your story, makes about $79,000 a year right now, correct?
Yeah, and that's actually from Census Bureau data. So that $79,000, about half is what the average American feels like they need to make. So Americans are nowhere near the level of comfortability that they feel like they need in this economy.
Anything else that we should know just about the average Americans trying to live comfortably? Any other numbers jump out at you?
Yeah, I think what beyond just the lifestyle inflation piece, what's interesting to me is just looking at generations. So younger generations feel like they need to earn more than older generations to live comfortably. But to consider themselves rich, which we defined as differently than living comfortably, those older generations are actually requiring more. It's interesting to look at that because I think where Gen Z and millennials might be coming in, I mean, they were saying that on average they need to earn about $200,000 a year just to live comfortably. You know, maybe that magic number, they're kind of thinking about what inflation is going to look like throughout the course of their working careers. And, you know, if they've come of age at a time of high inflation already, you know, it might just be part of their expectations for the future, too.
Yeah, well, but if I had to pick one, I think, well, everybody, I guess, has their own thought process about this. But if you're young and you're earning money, you still have time to earn more and save more. Time is on your side. If you're older, it is not. Hopefully, when you get to the finish line or near it, you are positioned to be comfortable. But if you aren't or don't think you will be, and you're in your 20s, you've got 50 years to fix it. So that's not so scary to me. The demographics and the numbers are in a very interesting story at bankrate.com. Sarah Foster is an economy reporter there. Nice to talk to you today, Sarah.
Thanks for having me as always, John.
Dennis Rodkin is a residential real estate reporter here in town for Crane's Chicago Business. Pops in once in a while to catch us up on either trends or celebrity profiles. Which is your favorite?
Oh, both, John. The good thing is the Beat has so many things going on. When I get bored of the real estate trends, there's probably a sports figure selling a house and vice versa.
Well, Justin Fields' house was on the market. I don't know if he sold it or not. A couple million dollars. I saw that the other day. I think I saw a story about Caleb Williams buying some property. Jonathan Taves sold his or is selling his Lincoln Park condo.
Selling his condo in Lincoln Park, yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because these are young men who probably don't have a lot of home buying experience because only now are they millionaires. And they're not going to live in that city that much. They're on the road for several months when they're playing their sports. And the career arcs of these guys are they're not going to be in town long anyway. I mean, not many people are in a town as long as Jonathan Taves is, for instance. All of that to say, I wonder why then they buy such big old properties that will require furnishings and thought. And even if you're rich, it's just a lot to manage. And then you got to sell it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't talked to all of the ones I've written about over the years because I've written most of them don't talk to me. But there have been enough of them who've talked to me or managers who've talked to me that I know, one, you're a young guy and a ton of money is being thrown at you and this is a way to spend it. Two, investment managers tell you that one of the best ways to invest your money is in real estate. Yeah. However, then they find that in Chicago it becomes difficult for them to sell. There are a lot of them who rent now because it's harder to get. I mean, look at Michael Jordan. He's been trying to sell his house for 12 years. So a lot of them now rent, but they rent at the super high end. But if they buy, the investment manager said to do this, but also a lot of times it's for security. Justin Fields' house happens to be something I ride my bike past about once a week. It's on one of my bicycle routes, but he's in a place in Lake Forest where people are going to leave him alone, you know, relatively large piece of property. I just don't want fans showing up at my front door, et cetera.
Yeah. So if you were in Wrigleyville, you know, just hang, but which members of the Cubs have done before.
That is amazing to me that members of the Cubs, there are some who have bought so close to Wrigley Field that you think, you know, do you eventually get really irritated by the fact that people know there he goes, here he comes?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a life. I mean, I'm trying to remember the name of the pitcher who had a really nice piece of property around there, and he'd be in one of the bars sometimes, and people would say, "Hey, and Ryan." I'm not talking about Ryan Dempster, but they would, you know, pat him on the back and talk him up a little bit, and then they'd leave him be, and he's kind of a fixture in the neighborhood, That sounds pretty cool, too.
Yeah, it does. And there was, I think we've talked about this, there was a time in the 1990s when most of the Bulls and their coach would all buy in the Highland Park, Deerfield, Bannockburn area because the practice facility, the Berto Center, was up there. And you hear people talk about trick-or-treating at their houses.
Yeah,
or,
right.
You know, the Tony Kukoc's wife had a shoe store and people in Highland Park, and people like to go, you know, I bought these shoes at Tony Kukoc's wife's store.
Everybody that went to Michael Jordan's house for Halloween got a brand new pair of Air Jordans. You know, if I were him, I would just give that away. I would just give it to the Park District, that piece of property.
I have actually suggested that in stories at the time because it is actually, it's right next door to a nature preserve. And so, you know, take his couple of acres and subsume them into the nature preserve. But I think his signature is on that house. I don't think he'd want to see it demolished.
Jonathan Toews, $4.7 million.
This is a really nice condo. And it's funny because I've done two stories about it in recent weeks for a reason. When it first went on the market, first reported by my competitor at the Tribune, but then I got some more details, there were no photos available. I knew the building because I wrote about it when it went condo. It's a 1920s parking garage that was turned into condos and some floors added above. It's on Orleans in Lincoln Park. And there were no photos. So then this week, it actually went on the open market, and I got a hold of the photos before it actually hit the listing sites. And you're looking at them. It's pretty amazing. $4.7 million. One of the main attributes of this place is the rooftop deck, where he's got a big pergola over a cooking and dining space. He's got fountains. He's got a view. The building is a block off Lincoln Park, but because of where he is, he looks east, across some other buildings and over all of the park.
Yeah,
that's quite a rooftop deck.
Yeah, the pictures make it look very sterile. I mean, you would never guess in a million years that a hockey star is the owner of this place. It could be anybody that owns it, but I guess that's what you try and do is strip out the personality, even if it's a celebrity, huh?
Yeah, I think you do. Yes, I think if he had jerseys on the wall or pictures of himself, most of those get removed. It is funny, though, how many people have signed Bulls jerseys from the 90s in their home, and those are in the listings photos, but generally you're a fan, not an athlete.
Okay, if you got $4.7 million in Lincoln Park and you want to own a beautiful place with a lot of open floor space, pick up Jonathan Toews' Lincoln Park condo. Chicago gives first-time home buyers more buying power. What's this story?
This was an interesting study that looked at about 100 major U.S. cities, but I narrowed it down to just the top 10 because, you know, little cities really aren't competing with Chicago. But of the 10 major U.S. cities, Chicago gives first-time home buyers the biggest buying power. That is, a median price first-time home buyer can afford about 38% of the homes that are on the market, which is a larger share of the market than is true in any other major U.S. city. Most of them, it's down in the 20-15% range. The idea is that, well, that's just another measure of how much more affordable Chicago is than most cities. And that's despite the fact that our affordability is going away quickly. Our home prices are rising faster than most of the nation because we've stayed pretty strong during the past couple of years as a lot of markets have really started to sink. Our affordability, I think if you can afford 38% of the homes this year, a year ago it was about 44% of the homes. So affordability is going away quickly in Chicago, yet we remain, for first-time homebuyers, one of the most affordable big city.
Richer or deeper housing stock would alleviate some of that, wouldn't it?
Oh, for sure, yeah. If we had more homes on the market, prices would not be rising as fast.
In New York, only 8% of the homes, 8%. In Los Angeles, 1%. In Houston, 18%. Washington, D.C., 19%. Miami, 14%. Phoenix, only 10% of the homes are within the buying power of first-time homebuyers.
So clearly, this is primarily important to people who are in that first-time buyer position. If I'm buying up to my next or third home, if I'm downsizing, these figures don't matter quite as much to me. But affordability is a very important measure for young adults who want to get into home ownership.
There's a River North apartment building converting to condos. I want you to talk about that and a little bit more about the impact that interest rates are or are not having on the market. We're talking to Dennis Rodkin, residential real estate reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. And we've got more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Motorola Solutions has announced plans to open a research and development center in Cork, Ireland. The Chicago-based company will hire 200 people to design software for public safety radios. The center's expected to open early next year. Motorola previously had a manufacturing center in Cork. This is the second offshore research and development center announced in recent months by Motorola. Last month, the company confirmed plans for a center in Vietnam that'll focus on artificial intelligence and data analytics. Another big company is downsizing its office footprint. Crain's reports Aon is cutting its suburban office space with a move to Bannockburn from Lincolnshire. Aon has about 800,000 square feet of space in Lincolnshire, and this report says the new location in Bannockburn would only be about 40,000 square feet. Aon's lease for the Lincolnshire property is expiring this year. Remote work has forced companies to downsize dramatically following the COVID pandemic, and they've left behind about 3.8 million square feet of workspace across the Chicago suburbs since 2020. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And are you one of the people who glance at your Fitbit countless times a day to see what your step count is?
I remember when the first Fitbit came out, and I thought, you know, that is going to be really useful if we can get that in cattle someday.
A Fitbit for cows?
They're a little more advanced than that. It's not just a step counter.
Who he is and why his company created a Fitbit for cows, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and Chevy Drive Chicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Andrew Uden is on the phone.
I'm the CEO of Herd Dog Inc.
And what is Herd Dog?
Herd Dog is a data analytics and livestock biometric company.
So basically the Fitbit for cows, but it isn't like your Fitbit.
You know, we don't do heart rate.
And it isn't strapped to the cow's wrist or ankle. It hangs from the cow's ear.
It's a Bluetooth-based ear tag, so we collect 480 data points per animal per day. And all of that goes to the cloud every 20 minutes.
And if it detects something wrong, like a fever or a change in activity that may mean the animal is sick.
We then have a light on the tag. And as soon as somebody gets nearby the animals with our app on their phone, it'll automatically turn on the lights on the ear tags of the cattle that need to be treated.
Ear tags have long been used by ranchers and farmers to identify their cattle, generally just a tag with a number on it. But Herd Dog's tags don't have numbers.
Yeah, so our tag is basically like an inch and a half diameter circle. There's no number on the face of the tag itself. It's embedded into the chip that's on the tag.
All of that high tech sounds expensive. No.
It's about 7 cents a day. So $2 a month or so.
They're getting very popular.
At about 5,000 on the market today. We're hoping to get another 10,000 mark or on the market next month.
Herddog.com for more info.
Two D's, two G's.
Checking the calendar. Oh, would you look at this?
Holy cow!
It is National Cow Appreciation Day. It's also National Sugar Cookie Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. Upper price condos or Chicago homes sales up while market sags. This doesn't surprise me that the higher end of the spectrums will more easily thrive or survive in a market like this.
Not at all a surprise, but at the middle of the year and at the end of the year, I always look at what's going on in that upper market. And it was very interesting to see how far apart they are. I didn't only compare. At the end of the first 6 months, sales of homes at $4 million and up, which is the upper 0.1% of all sales, were up from last year. But also, I and sales at all prices were way down from last year. But the other thing I did is compare them to 2019, which is the last normal year before we had COVID and the big housing boom, and then the crash that came, or the decline that came with rising interest rates. And home sales at all prices are down about 38% from 2019. Just
really?
Not catching up.
Is that Chicago or nationally?
In the Chicago area. This is just our local market. Yet at $4 million and up, they're well above 2019. So again, not a surprise that people who are not sensitive to interest rates are continuing to buy, but they're buying at higher numbers than the last normal year, while at all prices, which includes $4 million and up, but everything else as well, sales are way, way down.
That doesn't mean, though, that the house I bought in 2019 is selling for a lot less in 2024, does it?
No, this is the volume of sales. This is the number of sales, not prices. Prices are, I don't have the number in front of me, but they went up by about 20% in 2022 alone.
And they aren't selling, that is, those houses aren't on the market just because of interest rates, inventory, people not willing to move. Is that it?
Yeah. An awful lot of people are locked in by an interest. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Take your time. Fix that.
Thanks. A lot of people are locked in by an interest rate down in the 3 or 4% level. And the interest rates have doubled since spring 2022, when the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates to get a control over inflation. Inflation has not slowed down in the housing market, though it has overall. Home prices in the Chicago area are up about 8% this year, even with these higher interest rates. So a lot of people have said, then I just won't put my house on the market.
Is the thinking that if we had a full half point cut to one quarter cuts this year, would that be noticeable in the housing market?
Well, one of the things we have to look at is when people took out their mortgages, because if I have a mortgage from, say, 2010, 2012, 2015, I may now have, the house may have risen enough that the interest rate is not as important, and I'm really eager to move because my life has changed a lot in that length of time. However, if I bought my house right toward the end there of the boom, 2021, early 2022, my interest rate is really low, and it's going to take a long time for prices to catch up to the point where not only can I clear when I leave the house, leave this property, but I can buy something, buy the next property affordably. So a half a point, let's see, that'll come down into the 6% range. But we were in the 3% range in 2021 and early 2022.
Give me the quick upsell on the Wells condo building.
Second building in the last month where the owner has announced that rentals are going to condo. We've spent about the last 8 years, if not 10, seeing buildings in the city go the opposite direction from condo to rental. And now there was one on Lakeshore Drive that I think I talked about here. And now there's one on Wells in River North where the owners are turning them from rental into condo, in part because there's very little inventory at that first-time non-luxury level, the $450,000, $750,000 range, which to some people sounds like a lot, but it is where a lot of people enter the condo market.
Okay, I'm glad you said that because $750,000 is rich for a lot of folks.
Yeah. It's everything under $1 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, but $400,000, $443,000 is the number you quoted, is where these condos will start. That's a number some people can do.
Right. And there are very few, there's almost none of that being built.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons this developer has made the change, not the only reason, is that it's now hard to exit an apartment building you own profitably. We've seen several apartment buildings sell at big discounts. So I don't really want to sell this in bulk. How about if I sell the pieces one at a time as condos?
Right. So then people own them outright, will be charged with selling it on their own.
Right.
They'll pay an association fee, but at least it's not a rental, which is more fluid for people to get in and out.
Right. And one of the reasons to do this is that there is so much inventory of rentals now, including the new ones, that there may be less appeal to renters in a building that was built in 2016.
Yeah.
I can go to those super fabulous ones that have just been built.
Yeah.
Whereas a condo buyer, especially a condo buyer in the $500,000 range, wants to maximize what they can get.
Dennis Rodkin with another cool shirt. Residential real estate reporter at Crane's Chicago Business. Read his stuff at chicagobusiness.com. Thank you, Dennis.
Thanks, John. Sorry about the throat.
Yeah, you sound great.